This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rural North Carolinians are more likely to have serious health problems than their urban counterparts. Those health disparities have been well documented over the past few decades. On average, people who live in rural areas of the state have lower life expectancy. They have higher incidence of chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes. What's going on? Well, rural hospitals have been shutting down, leaving local populations more vulnerable. And systemic problems like slow economic growth and spotty insurance coverage also contribute to poor health outcomes. Despite all of those trends, there are indications that rural health care systems can survive if they adapt their business models to changing landscapes of modern health care, including policy changes under the Affordable Care Act. Today, we'll explore the challenges that face rural health care systems and the opportunities to improve them. And we're going to start with Adam O'Neill. He's the mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. It's a small town in Beaufort County along the Pungo River in eastern North Carolina. The town was home of Vidon Pungo Hospital until it closed in 2014. Last summer, Mayor O'Neill walked nearly 300 miles from Belhaven to Washington, D.C. in an effort to raise awareness about rural hospital closures across the country. And he did it again this year with Bob Zellner, a prominent civil rights leader in North Carolina. Adam O'Neill joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Tell us about Belhaven, North Carolina, and the role that Vidon Pungo Hospital played there.
Well, our hospital had been in town since about 1949. It was the first Hill-Burton hospital in the country. That was an effort by Democrats and Republicans coming together back in the 40s to establish rural hospitals and rural health out in the rural areas. And our hospital was the first one in the country. I had been there operating successfully for years. And about 2012, Vidon Health came into town, took over a hospital. They didn't buy it. They took it over with about $1 million assets, more assets and liabilities. And then within 2 years, ended up closing our hospital.
Yeah, Vidon's a nonprofit.
Vidon's a nonprofit. In the year that they closed our Hill-Burton Hospital, the first Hill-Burton Hospital in the country, our critical access hospital, our emergency services, to 15,000 to 20,000 people. In that year, they made $109 million. The previous year, they made $127 million. They had $700 million of reserves and saw fit to close our little hospital that was losing about half of what their CEO was making. What? And it's been devastating to our community.
What did the community do to try to save the hospital?
We did everything. We've been very lucky that the NAACP got involved and filed a Title VI complaint. That brought on federal mediation. We went to a mediation meetings with the federal mediator, and Vidon reached a deal. Then Vidon undermined the mediation and then blamed the town for mediation not working out. So it's been a very tough struggle, and now Vidon loyalists are working to try and keep us from getting our hospital open back up. We have a USDA loan of $6 million that has been promised to the town as long as we get the building back, which the Vidon loyalists are trying to keep from us. And we get our CO in. So
we invited a representative of Vidon Health to join us in this conversation. That organization declined to participate or provide a comment. So tell us about the fallout. What's happened since the hospital closed?
Well, it's devastating. We're having people die. Portia Gibbs was the first instance. She was a lady, lived in Fairfield, North Carolina, had a heart attack. Her husband took her to Swan Quarter, North Carolina, where the paramedics were. That was about 25 miles from Belhaven. They waited for a helicopter. Took an hour for the helicopter to get there. She passed away as the helicopter landed. That was about 4 days after our hospital closed. Before, in 25 minutes, when she got to Swan Quarter, she would have been at the hands of an ER physician. 45 minutes into that hour, she was still talking to rescue personnel. So she would have been at the arms of an ER physician, but there wasn't one. And people need to understand, a helicopter is not a saving grace. A helicopter doesn't fly if it's foggy. A helicopter doesn't fly if it's high winds. The other thing is, they don't put you on a helicopter unless you're stable. Well, if you're out and you've had a car accident and you've got people that aren't stable, they don't put them on the helicopter. We had someone bleed to death because the helicopter landed. They went to the patient, and he was bleeding badly and not stable. They just took right back off. You put them on the ambulance and carry them an hour away. So we're having people die. There's a lot of passion. It's something that won't go away, and we're going to keep fighting until we have our hospital open again, because we've had business plans, three done, that show our hospital can be successful. The reason our hospital failed was because we had 129 employees when we needed 55. We had a hospital that needed to be right-sized. But when Vidant bought our hospital, we thought they would do the things it took to make it sustainable. But instead, they knew from the time they bought our hospital, or didn't buy it, took it over, that they were going to close our hospital to beef up nearby Washington, North Carolina's hospital, Vidant Beaufort. So they had a game plan when they came to our community, misrepresented to our community what they were going to do, and then stole our hospital away. And that's why we're fighting.
As we said, we've invited Vidant representatives. They declined to be on the program or give us a statement. So, and the nearest hospital now is in Washington. It's about 30 miles away. But as you point out, it's 30 miles from Belhaven, but there are other people who are going to Belhaven, right? Tell us
50
more.
Miles. Wow. We already have people going 50 miles to get to Belhaven. There was a study done in Europe about heart attacks. Every 10 miles you have to travel with a heart attack, the chance of you dying from that heart attack goes up 10%. So we just had everybody's chance of dying from a heart attack in our area go up 30% based on a nonprofit that made $109 million closing a critical access hospital.
So let's talk about how these hospital companies get in business and are in a position to even choose which hospitals to open and close. Talk about access. One of the things that happened in this state, of course, is that the state chose to not to participate in the ACA, and as a result, about 500,000 people were not in Medicaid expansion didn't happen. Did that have any impact on you?
Well, it has a terrific impact. Our business plan is actually show us performing without Medicaid expansion, but Medicaid expansion makes it where these hospitals do well. Because what happened with the Affordable Care Act is your indigent reimbursements, the people who can't pay, with the Affordable Care Act, they start falling. They reduce every year. And Medicaid expansion is to fill that hole. Well, if you don't accept Medicaid expansion as a state, you have these falling indigent care reimbursements, and you have nothing to fill the hole. So that's what's happening to a lot of hospitals. They don't have the revenues. And the amount of money that Medicaid expansion brings to North Carolina is about $4 billion, with a B, billion dollars. Now, imagine taking $4 billion out of North Carolina's healthcare system. Do you think that has an effect?
Well, now, your fellow Republicans in the legislature and your fellow Republican Pat McCrory say, look, we can't be expanding a program that is, and they called it broken. Mm-hmm. We need to fix that thing first and then go help the people of Belhaven.
Well, Governor McCrory has actually tried to help us what he can. He really has been a friend of Belhaven, and he's working helping us now. I think some of the Republicans know that they're going to have to expand Medicaid in the future. I think they're trying to figure out how to do it politically because there are some extremely conservative people in the Republican Party that don't want anything to do with Medicaid expansion because Obama's name's connected to it, basically. I met with the Health and Human Services Director of Virginia on our last walk, which we walked for the 283 rural hospitals that are facing closure this year. And they had a financial guy come in who was nonpartisan. The governor asked him to do a study on Medicaid expansion. He said he listed all the pros and cons. He said there were hardly any cons, and all the cons were overcome by the pros. Something, one of the pros would offset it. He said there was absolutely no reason. So it's a purely political thing, and we've got to remember it's about the people. When we get to a position where we're not thinking about the people, and we're hung up in the politics and the people are suffering, we need to make a change.
Well, access to care is, of course, one of the important elements in all of this. Is our conversation on rural health care is going to continue this hour. Talk about the kind of dynamics. You talk about a hospital, right-sized, would have 57 employees and all of the services around that. The money that flows through and the impact on Belhaven. And again, the economic impact that helps lift health indicators, right?
It makes no sense to close these rural hospitals. The reason is they're economic engines for these communities. In our community, closing our hospital, which lost about $1.2 million or something last year to community operated it, losing that hospital, the economic devastation is $17 million a year to that community. Now, that's worth the state making sure these hospitals don't close. It's worth the counties making sure. But politics, just like in our county, we have a situation where our county commissioners, all but one of them, don't really support the hospital because Vidant's got their tentacles in them. And it's politics instead of people. And we have a situation across this country, across this state, in these counties, where people are not focused on the people. Our politics is losing its way. We're forgetting about the people. It's like people say, well, you're a Republican. How can you be involved in Medicaid expansion? Because it's right. And
what
if it's right, you have to work.
Beyond Medicaid expansion, is there other legislation here in the state or nationally that could help out?
Well, I'm very happy to say that the walk that we did from June 1st to June 15th, with 22 states, we had 22 states come to Belhaven, Texas, Colorado, New York, Minnesota, Wisconsin, a lot of states came to Belhaven because we were the first Hill-Burton Hospital and we're closed and walked 283 miles to Washington, D.C. The Rural Health Association, the National Rural Health Association, endorsed our walk and also used it to pressure lawmakers to do something. The result of that has been Senator Grassley from Iowa has introduced a bill for rural hospitals. It's about halfway of where it needs to be, is what I'm told. Representative Sam Graves from Missouri is about to introduce a bill that's supposed to be completely all-encompassing of the issues that deal with rural hospitals. So we're going to continue to push this for Belhaven, but we're also affecting a national audience with what's going on in Belhaven. And it's just shocking and sad that Vidant Health wants to be on the side of trying to stop good things from happening, not only in Belhaven and East North Carolina, but in the country.
What's happening now to try to bring, I know there's an effort to bring at least emergency services to Belhaven, right?
No. I mean, we've got to open a hospital. Vidant Health, we've got four clinics in town. Vidant Health is building a new clinic because they own all four clinics now because they bought out the doctors. So they're combining the four clinics into one clinic. This new clinic they're building, they're trying to promote it as something it's not. It actually is a facility that emergency vehicles can't even go to. If you have a heart attack, stroke, trauma, you can't go there. It's a doctor's office. So a lot of people have misunderstood that.
Adam O'Neill, the mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
As we said, we invited representatives of Vidant Health to join us in this conversation. They declined to participate or send a statement with us. On today's program, we are talking about the state of rural health care, the challenges of delivering it to a rural population, also some opportunities to improve it. Just ahead, we're going to take a closer look at health disparities across the state. And you'll hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, we're talking about rural health care systems, the challenges they face, and how they might adapt to new policies and ways to deliver health care to underserved populations. Joining me now is Mark Holmes. He's director of the Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Mark, welcome to the program. Good to
Thanks.
Be here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
What would you say? I mean, this is obviously a very complicated story, but the largest health, the health care disparities in rural and urban areas today, how do they show up? How do we see them?
Well, I think you want to talk about just real briefly what you mentioned earlier, and that is the trend over the last 30 years is quite remarkable, with comparable mortality in 1979 national based on the rural, and here we are 34 years later, and it's a gap of about 20% roughly in terms of mortality comparing urban to rural. And there are many factors that are driving that. In terms of specific conditions, heart disease mortality is much higher in rural areas, and then also trauma, often from motor vehicle accidents and unanticipated injuries.
I guess you might have to speculate, but just to stick with trauma for a minute, does that get what Adam O'Neill was saying? You have to go farther to get to a hospital.
Well,
right?
If you're farther from a hospital and the level of services are different, level one trauma center versus a much more modest facility, distance for the ambulance and emergency medicine to get to the site of the accident and return, and lots of drivers in that. And even more fundamentally, rural roads are often curvier and people are going faster on them. And mm-hmm. so you're at can be at higher risk even of an higher incidence.
Now, we were talking about hospital closures, but what else is going on here in these areas to create these disparities?
Well, I think you want to talk about healthcare access, as you mentioned, hospitals, healthcare professionals, particularly we normally think about physicians and the availability of physicians. There's a lot of public policy discussion about physician shortages. Do we have a shortage? Do we have a surplus? I think where most people kind of agree, we can disagree about whether there's a surplus or a shortage, but most people agree there's a major maldistribution problem where there are plenty of physicians in some areas and very marked shortages in others. And that's, I think, a very...
So where are the shortages?
They're typically found in rural areas, lower income areas, and there's also a racial disparity, places that are more likely or have higher rates of race and ethnic minorities are often more likely to have these types of shortages.
And this gets us back to this economic dynamic. If you're going to close a hospital, which had been some form of economic engine that might generate enough wealth to attract a doctor, now that's gone. So you can see the spiral.
Well, and you think of a hospital as the central nexus of the healthcare system in the rural community. And when that hospital leaves, Now, all of a sudden, the clinics that were across the street look around and say, well, I've lost a lot of my admitting privileges. Now I have to go farther. Maybe it doesn't make sense for me to go here anymore. And you start to see a withering on the vine of the strength of that healthcare system. And so it's not just the hospital per se, but the ancillary effects associated with that, home health, emergency medicine, emergency medicine transport, EMS systems, can be nursing homes and the like. And I think another thing to think about is from the economic standpoint, in many of rural communities in particular, the hospital is either the largest or the second largest employer. Largest is often the school system, and after that it's the hospital. And so when you lose your second largest employer, communities feel that.
What about, you talked about a trend that's been going on for some 20 or 30 years, 30 years or so. What about the impact of Medicaid expansion, the failure to do that in this state? Is there any way to measure that yet?
Well, I think it's still pretty early to really look at that. We've been tracking at the North Carolina Rural Health Research Center rural hospital closures like what's going on in Belhaven, or what happens in Belhaven. There's 54 closures since 2010 among rural hospitals. And those are disproportionately located in the South, where historically hospital finances have been weaker. Now, you can also look at that and say, well, the southern states have been less likely to expand Medicaid. And so are the higher closure rates in the South because of Medicaid not expanding, or is it just because of the finances in the South that have been weaker for decades? And it's hard to say, I have to put my statistical hat on for a moment there, but with only 54, it's really hard to sort of understand what the different drivers of that is. But I think it is important to think about. It's hard to imagine that Medicaid expansion would hurt these places.
Well, rural hospitals are often the heart of communities, as you say. And joining us now is a physician who practiced for most of her life in rural North Carolina. Dr. Pearlie Graham Hoskins is the hospitalist medical director at Bladen County Hospital in eastern North Carolina. She grew up a few miles from that facility, returned there to practice soon after completing medical school, and has been treating patients there for nearly 30 years. Dr. Pearlie Graham Hoskins joins us from member station WHQR in Wilmington. Dr. Graham Hoskins, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Bladen County and growing up in that area and medical care, I guess.
Our hospital is a small rural hospital located in a very rural area. Of course, like many other rural areas, we have a lot of poverty, low-income patients, low employment. We have limited access. We have limited assets, and we have limited financial reserves. And because of our small size and our demographics, that is, we have a very, very large population of Medicare and Medicaid patients, about 68%, 12% self-pay patients, and only 20% commercial patients, so it's difficult for us to shift off the cost of our care to our commercial patients. So we have a lot of challenges in our efforts to remain open. I came to the hospital about 28 years ago, and actually when we talk about recruitment of physicians, it was the community who recruited me. A group of gentlemen realized that they needed health care providers, and they heard that I was in town, and they actually sought to recruit me, and by living and practicing in the community, you develop friends, you develop relationships, and provide, I think, what is mission-minded service to rural patients.
Well, you went to med school at UNC Chapel Hill. You had a lot of opportunities. As you said, you were recruited to come back there. But why did you choose to go? I'm sure you were facing many of those challenges when they came to you.
Well, I think a physician has to be mission-minded. You realize that you're not in it for the money. You are not in it for prestige. But you realize that this is an area that needs assistance. When I came back, the hospital, and this is my home town, the hospital was very much in jeopardy of closing. The quality of care was questionable in the community. We were not Joint Commission accredited. And so I felt an obligation, a give-back obligation, to stay and see if there were anything that I could do to help to turn the hospital around.
Well, the hospital didn't close, and apparently you did turn it around, or at least helped. What happened? Why is Bladen County still open?
Well, initially, 28 years ago, we did have an aggressive group of leaders who turned the hospital around with commitment. We did gain Joint Commission accreditation, and actually one of the few hospitals in the country to be awarded all of the three American Hospital Association awards for turnaround. However, we ran into problems with our reimbursement, as was common for all rural hospitals. And we saw a period in which we were unable to sustain ourselves without losses. We saw the handwriting on the wall, and then affiliated with Cape Fear Valley Health System in Fayetteville. And that affiliation has been our salvation, in addition to changing to a critical access hospital status.
Well, and we heard Mayor O'Neill tell us what happens when you lose a hospital in terms of the impact on patients' lives lost. You recently had to implement your disaster protocol because of an accident at a nearby water park, and I think it illustrates what happens if you keep your hospital open. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. About 2 weeks ago, we had at White Lake Water Park a chlorine leak into one of the pools. We then saw 24, 25 children who came into our facility. The park is just a few miles from the hospital, and we were able to activate our disaster plan and take care of all of these children, have them triaged, treated, showered, and returned to their families within a period of just over 3 hours.
I mean, these are kids who suffered chemical burns, right? Yeah.
Correct, chlorine. Without Bladen County Hospital, then they would have needed to sought care over 30 miles, and that could have had an impact on the outcome for all of these children.
So Dr. Pearly Graham Hoskins is telling us about her experience in a rural hospital, and we've heard about the entire community and its support, what it takes to keep a hospital like this going. Adam Zolitor is president and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. He's also part of the state's Rural Health Task Force that wrote a report last year about rural health strategies. Dr. Zolitor, welcome to the state. Thanks. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Frank.
You heard Dr. Graham Hoskins talk about community culture in rural systems. Give us the scope of kind of the influences. What influences rural health care?
So I think I'd answer that two ways. I think that our task force really examined what influenced rural health and what influenced rural health care. So we really looked broadly at what the health outcomes were in rural compared to urban North Carolina. We looked at mortality, diabetes rates, smoking rates, poverty, higher education, and all the things that could be driving the health of rural communities. And we found some pretty impressive differences in rural and urban health in North Carolina. In terms of what's affecting health in North Carolina, I think that some of what we've already talked about, rural hospital closures, is very important. Also, access to care. And we really closely examined two issues related to access, insurance and availability of health insurance, as well as safety net care. And then access to healthcare providers in rural North Carolina. And we found really important discrepancies, particularly in terms of access to healthcare providers. In North Carolina, rates of uninsurance before the Affordable Care Act were about the same in rural and urban communities in North Carolina. But some of our poorest rural communities, 10 rural communities had rates of uninsurance in excess of 25% compared to a statewide average of 19%. So some of our rural counties have been very hard hit by lack of insurance, and I think that speaks to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid discussion earlier. But the other thing we looked at was healthcare provider shortage, and we tend to talk more about physician shortage. And in North Carolina, we have 66 primary care healthcare shortage areas, and 10 of those have been persistent primary care shortage areas for over a decade. We also have 69 dental professional shortage areas and 22 behavioral health professional shortage areas. So we have huge gaps in provider numbers. The threshold for being a primary care health profession shortage area is about 8 primary care physicians per 10,000. And in our persistent health profession shortage areas, there's an average of less than 2 primary care physicians per 10,000. And we have 10 of those counties. And in fact, they've had about 2 primary care physicians for 10,000 residents for the last 40 years.
What works? What, I mean, we heard Dr. Graham Hoskins talk about what drove her. She's mission driven. She's from that area. She went back home. What does it take to bring more doctors to those areas?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we've seen some things at work. We've found that Loan repayment, for example, for healthcare providers works better than scholarships. So we get people when they're graduating from residency, and we incentivize them to moving into rural areas. I think, you know, and one of the things that maybe Pearlie will talk about is identifying people when they're young. We think that we need to be getting kids from Bladen County when they're 10 and 12 years old. Find those promising students. Find those students that are motivated by the values of service, and encourage them, mentor them, and provide them educational opportunities, and get them to come back to their communities. We probably need to be looking at medical school recruitment and recruitment into nurse practitioner and PA programs to find people, again, that are mission-driven, people that want to return to those communities.
Well, let me ask Dr. Pearl Hoskins that now. Is that something, Dr. Graham Hoskins that now, is that something that you're involved in yourself, recruitment, and what do you do?
Recruitment is very difficult and challenging issue for us. The loan repayment is helps us to recruit physicians. The problem we have is that there's a revolving door. And after they satisfy their obligations, then they do not remain in the in the community, so that we are right back to square one as far as recruitment. I do think and Campbell now has opened a medical school, and hopefully they'll be producing a large number of primary care providers. And we have next week begin to preceptor medical students in a rural rotation, which I think is one of the ways that we can expose students at an earlier age than residency to rural areas. In addition, I think a rural residency program, which was mentioned in the task force summary, would attract physicians that are mission-minded, who are dedicated to serving rural areas, and therefore that would be some sustainable means by which we could recruit providers
and
physicians.
Adam Zolotour, the task force did talk about that, residencies, getting young doctors into those areas. Why is that a value? Why do you think that would help?
Well, I think it does a couple of things. I think number one, you're again recruiting for the people that are mission driven, that want to provide that kind of service as part of their career. It also prepares people to practice in that kind of environment. So I think that I'm a family physician, I work on faculty at the University of North Carolina. We train lots of residents, and they're used to having lots of specialists and lots of equipment and lots of services available. And as Dr. Graham Hoskins knows, you might not have a trauma surgeon available 24/7 in Bladen Community Hospital. And I think it's important that we start to train people or continue to train people in environments where they may have to use different kinds of resources.
What can happen, again, some recommendations at the policy level? What could the state do to improve the situation?
That's a great question. I think that one thing to mention is that there are two residency programs in North Carolina that have rural tracks, the University of North Carolina and Carolina's Medical Center. We struggle to fund new residency slots because of the way GME financing or graduate medical education financing, mostly from the federal government, comes down to the state. However, the state does control a fair bit of GME financing, and I think that there's an opportunity to incentivize both programs and potential candidates for those residencies slots to, again, recruit and place people in rural environments. So there's some discussion at the state level of what we're calling socially accountable graduate medical education funding, where you might pay programs more from the state graduate medical education dollars if they're placing residents in rural and underserved types of communities.
The program has changed a little bit. Mark Holmes, maybe you can explain how it changes in this program that were once sort of tuition-based, you know, we'll pay your tuition if you serve X number of years, to a kind of repayment program. Maybe you can explain how that worked and why it seems to be working better.
Well, Adam mentioned the difference between the scholarship, as you just said, and the loan repayment. And As I did my dissertation in this topic, and I was explaining to my family that think of Northern Exposure, that TV show from 20 years ago, where you have the doctor who signs up in medical school to get some of his tuition paid and then signs basically a blank contract on where he'll be placed 6 years later. And that didn't really work very well because people realized that 6 years later they really didn't want to move to Alaska, or they thought they were going to be a primary care physician and instead want to be an anesthesiologist and work in Manhattan. So back in the, mid-80s probably is when we usually started looking at these loan repayment programs, which shifted that decision much later and said, okay, you're done with your residency. You're ready to go out into the world. How about we'll give you some money to help repay your loan if you go to a place that we can negotiate together? And so that changed the balance of the of that transaction much more and made it more immediate. You weren't looking at something years later. And that's been – the loan repayment program has been far more successful, not only in reducing the contracts that weren't fulfilled, but also in making physicians more likely to stick in where they were. I mean, Dr. Graham Hoskins mentioned that there is sort of this revolving door, but some of them do stay. They get out there and for a couple of years and say, you know what, I can make this work. I like this. I didn't really know what I was getting into, but this is a good way of life, and I can stick around and keep this going. And so that loan repayment has been is where a lot of these programs are moving.
Well, we'll talk about some of the other things that might help make it work as we continue our conversation about rural health care on the State of Things. Just ahead, we're going to talk about opportunities to improve health care and one community where an independent rural hospital is thriving. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about rural health care. My guests are Mark Holmes, Director of the Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Adam Zolotor is President and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. Dr. Pearlie Graham Hoskins is the Hospitalist Medical Director at Bladen County Hospital in Eastern North Carolina. And we've been talking about the barriers to health delivery in rural communities. In recent years, of course, hospitals have been shutting down. But actually, there are some instances in which hospitals are not just surviving, but actually thriving in rural communities. One of those examples is Putnam County Memorial Hospital in rural Missouri. Rather than cut services, Putnam Memorial stayed in business by expanding treatment options. So joining us now to explain how that worked is Jerry Cummings. He is the COO of Putnam County Memorial Hospital in Unionville, Missouri. Jerry Cummings, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Glad to be aboard.
Give us the state of Putnam County Memorial when you stepped in.
Well, we were sort of like Belhaven. Our county is basically a county of less than 5,000 people, mostly Medicare, Medicaid. And back in 2012, they had been negotiating because the hospital was running less than one patient a day average, and like most rural hospitals, was struggling. So they were negotiating with a large hospital to take it over, and they negotiated for about 6 months. And then in February of 2012, that hospital indicated they felt that the hospital needed to close, that they could handle everything. So they cut them off, and then how we got involved as a provider in the area up here in rural Putnam County, called us and indicated that the hospital was probably going to close and really thought that possibly we might be of assistance in keeping it open. So it just so happened that when they built the new hospital or renovated the new hospital in 2006, they did the revenue bonds, and they went with 15 beds. But at that time, they had in the old hospital, they had a wing of 10 beds that was going to shut down. And back in 2006, I'd actually done a performer for the CEO back then, that if he would take those 10 beds and convert them to a inpatient psychiatric facility, which is very well needed in the area, that would certainly help on the income.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to stop you there because that's curious. What you do this pro forma, you do this kind of business plan, and you come up with adding psychiatric beds. Where did that come from?
Well, that comes because if you look at the small hospitals, like, they got to create a niche. You know, you got the larger hospitals around you. You got to find something that's going to make it and going to make you unique. And so that's the reason why I thought the design and application of a 10-bed psychiatric unit, which there wasn't anything within 100 miles, would be a very attractive avenue to bring in additional revenues to help help the hospital as a whole to stay in existence.
And it worked, right?
Well, we did the performance, and it showed that it would. When we presented it, we didn't hear anything, so we just assumed that everybody just assumed that it wasn't a good idea. And so they dropped it. So when I got a call, I actually called the CEO at the time and told him about this psychiatric thing. And he talked to it's a county-owned hospital, so he talked to the board. They asked to meet with us on February 28th. So we said, okay, we would come up and meet with them and then reintroduce the psychiatric thing. We thought that would be a good idea for them to do. Well, when we got up and they asked us to come in, and we presented it, they said that never did get to them, so they were interested in pursuing it. So we were asked to come in March 1st, which was the next Monday. When we walked in, when I did the performer, I had estimated it would take about $600,000 to do the renovation of the old facility, you know, to get it up and going. So I wanted to find out the financial condition of the hospital. When I walked in, when we walked in that Monday morning, I asked how much money we had in the bank. Well, we had a total in the bank of $8,000, and we had two payrolls that month of $70,000 apiece. And we, like I said, we had run like five straight days without one patient in a hospital, one patient in ER, one patient in a clinic. And so you know, it was kind of tough getting things going, but the fact that we were able to manage other physicians, we were able to bring in some primary care physicians initially within the first 30 days. So by bringing in and adding the services back, we had not done surgeries in 10 years. Our physical therapy department had shut down. They were shutting everything down. They were telling the employees they should find another job, and we had like 43 employees, but we continued. We added physical therapy was the first thing we did. Then we added outpatient psych. Then we did the renovation. We did a GO bond, which we was able to get the dollars we didn't have to borrow through the bond issue, the new bond issue, to pay off the old bonds and save about $2.5 million.
Right.
And plus we was able to do the renovation, which helped us get the psych thing up and going.
So how's the hospital doing today?
Well, we went less than one patient a day. Now we're running around 11 to 12 patients a day average. Our revenues went from a little less than $5 million about 2.5-3 years ago to this year. They were $22 million. Mm-hmm. Next year, I think we're going to be pretty close to $30-some million. When I talk about getting niches, you know, it's just, you know, not that we did everything right. It's just finding those things that nobody else does. For an example, we're embarking now on a program where we're treating, I don't know if the people out there are familiar with the Amish population and with the Mennonites.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do health services, you know, they pay cash for everything. And we're running about 80-90% Medicare and Medicaid. And as you know, critical access, you know, Medicare only is giving you 99% of your costs. So you'd lose if you're up there. So we've got to bring in other sources of revenue other than Medicare and Medicaid. And that's where the Amish and the Mennonite. We started that program about 2.5 months ago, and we've expanded our base. We're basically, what that is that most of the Mennonites and the Amish, when they need surgeries because they pay cash, they can go to Tijuana, Mexico, or they go to Ohio, or they go to Fort Wayne, Indiana, or Northern Indiana. And so we're trying to fill that niche here in Missouri and handle the areas around here. And based on our population, where we're working with the Amish right now, our base, you know, our potential base has went up to around 38,000 people that need minor surgeries, and they could come here for them.
Well, Jerry, I want to talk about this business model to our panelists as well, because I think you're presenting some interesting possibilities. Mark Holmes, you know, first thing I want to ask you is something that Jerry said. He said, well, we were down to less than one patient a day. Well, it sounds to my ear like you don't need a hospital.
Well, I mean, there are some people who make that argument, and the question comes down to what do you need in a hospital? Is it an inpatient facility? Do you need an emergency room? You know, we think of a hospital in one model, but I think one of the lessons of Putnam County is that rural areas need to look at what they need in their community, and every solution is going to be different. And the Amish Mennonite business strategy is one that wouldn't work in a lot of places, but it does in Putnam, and you have to really understand your community to figure out what is it that we need, what can we do, and what's going to work best here.
Yeah, Adam Zolotar, what about that? I mean, this is a real business plan we're talking about. It's not about, you know, expanding Medicaid or any of those other things. Jerry's come up with a business plan. He does a pro forma, and he appeals to the business community. So tell us a little bit more about how that might be applied to North Carolina.
So in our experience looking at rural communities in North Carolina, every rural community is different. We went sort of on a listening tour. We went to 8 rural communities in North Carolina and met with folks. And I think that Jerry's plan is a good one in Putnam County. And I think that you'd find that in some communities in North Carolina, people would come up with different plans. And I think that Mark mentioned, you know, maybe we just need an emergency room. And I think that in Belhaven, The woman that Mayor O'Neill was talking about, who had a heart attack and was waiting for EMS at Swan Quarter, maybe if they had a full-service 24/7 emergency facility staffed by emergency room physicians, she would have survived. She could have gotten treatment quickly, but she might not have stayed at Bellhaven. And so I think it's going to look different in different communities.
The other thing you looked at was some of the other aspects of the community, economic development, education. How important, what kind of role do they play?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we looked at this really from the perspective of what are the things that are impacting the health of people that live in rural communities. And so we were really purposeful. We didn't just want to spend a year talking about getting more doctors or opening new hospitals in rural communities, but we wanted to think about the things that determined health. And I also think that, you know, we've seen a trend over the last 30 years that much more healthcare is taking place outside of hospitals than inside of hospitals. And so strengthening the rural healthcare delivery system is one part of that. That's recruiting and retaining healthcare providers of all types. And one of the things that both determines health and improves our ability to recruit and retain healthcare providers is to make sure that there are job opportunities for partners. Make sure that that the educational system in the community is strong so that healthcare providers that are being recruited want to send their kids to those schools. Making sure that there's adequate mental health and substance abuse services in a community. So we're really looking at kind of the full scope of what are the most important things that we as experts at the state level and the 260 people we met with in rural communities think are going to really impact the health in their communities.
Mark?
And I think one thing that Adam mentioned, which I want to underline, is the notion of connectedness. And a rural community is connected to the county borders aren't hard. They aren't the Berlin Wall. People can cross over them. And counties like Beaufort or Bladen are going to have different kinds of needs in terms of its connectedness than something like Eastern Johnston or Eastern Union County, which we probably look at and think of as rural. But when so many of your people are commuting into Charlotte or to Raleigh, it's going to be a different strategy than in more isolated communities.
And Adam, you've actually found, I mean, in terms of trying to recruit physicians, there are averages that show improvements in, quote, rural areas, yeah. But not all rural areas are alike.
Right. I think that the thing that was striking when we were looking at the number of physicians in rural communities is that we have these healthcare professional shortage areas and we have whole county health profession shortage areas, and then we have these persistent healthcare shortage areas. The persistent whole county health profession shortage areas, there are 10 in North Carolina, and the rates of physician to resident population have not budged in 40 years. Mm. When we look at Park County health profession shortage areas, we've actually done a pretty good job of getting doctors to come and stay, and our rates have gone from about 5 per 10,000 to about 8 or 9 per 10,000, which is near urban county rates of physicians. So it's really these whole county persistent primary care shortage areas that are really the most desperate. And I don't think we've made much ground in the last 40 years.
And the improvements that have been made are in so-called rural counties that are quickly developed. Chatham is considered a rural county, but of course very close to the urban areas that are attractive. Right. So I wonder, Pearly Graham Hoskins, when you talk with physicians, when you do recruiting for people, how important to them are these questions that you hear Adam Zolotar talking about? You know, the education system, job opportunities for partners. Does that come up in your conversations?
They are absolutely critical. And many times we are unable to attract physicians because of the lack of good education, of jobs for the spouse, of just the overall environment. If you are moving your family to a community that does not have a movie theater, then that's not very attractive. It may be attractive to the physician that he will be busy and practicing, but certainly not to his or her spouse or family. So that I think one of the things that we need to look at is how communities can be assisted in improving their environments, improving the economic, overall economic environment, the job status and unemployment status, education status, and providing recreational and extra facilities for people in the community.
Well,
it's very critical in communities and leaders in rural areas may need some assistance with something like capacity building to look at the process by which they can enhance their ability to identify what the challenges are and how to make a plan and how to understand the obstacles that may be inhibiting them from realizing their goals.
Well, again, if you get back to Medicaid expansion, if you expand it, then that spends dollars in those communities that assist in economic development. If you don't do that, the money doesn't get spent back into those communities. Jerry Cummings, and, I know, like
I,
North.
Can I just say that, that we have the issue now with outpatient and inpatient shifts. Many of our physicians now travel into town to do their, to work their shifts, and then they travel back 1 hour out of the rural areas. And so we have now an issue in which we have very limited physicians who actually physically reside in our community.
And where do they live then?
In neighboring cities that Fayetteville, Wilmington, right. Leland, and the like. And so they can drive an hour, they can commute an hour and be to work a shift, and then return to their community. And that's a loss, because then their involvement locally in the community is lost and
right.
problematic.
Right. Well, so Adam Zolotari, is this something at the policy level? I mean, you sent a recommendation to the task force, did, to the legislature. You know, what are they? I don't have too much time left, but the key provisions, and how is it received?
So I think that one of the issues was that 2 years ago, the budget from the Office of Rural Health and Community Care was cut by about $2 million a year. They were having trouble keeping up with certifying health profession shortage areas and providing recruitment and retention services to rural communities. So there was a recommendation to restore funding to the Office of Rural Health and Community Care. My understanding is that that has not gone anywhere yet. I think that we're in a difficult financial climate for investing new monies in state government, and that's certainly something I understand. We typically take a 5-year time horizon, and so I'm hopeful that this is not off the table.
Actually, GDP is on the rise, so yeah. Economically we're fine. Politically, there might be another issue, but I will say, economically, things are on the rise. Continue.
Agreed.
GDP, by the way, since that Hill-Burton Hospital in the Truman administration was created, and a whole system of network of rural hospitals built by the federal government, GDP has expanded 6 times in real terms since then. So you do wonder how, if it was possible then, why it wouldn't be possible when we have 6 times the wealth.
Well, To answer that question, I guess I would wonder how many times healthcare cost has expanded while GDP has expanded sixfold, because we certainly know that getting healthcare is a heck of a lot more expensive now than when Hill-Burton was enacted. I think that the other recommendations are less to our state policymakers and more to educational institutions and local communities. When we talk about, you know, and Pearlie said it best, I was recruited by my community. I think it's the community has to be involved. There has to be a match, and we need to be looking for those matches and helping facilitate those matches.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Dr. Adam Zolotari is president and CEO of North Carolina Institute of Medicine. Dr. Pearlie Graham-Hoskins is the hospitalist medical director at Bladen County Hospital. Jerry Cummings, COO of Putnam County Memorial Hospital in Missouri. Mark Holmes is the director of Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai, the intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. Special thanks to Will Michaels and Bout Time Public Media for their help with today's program. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.